Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire state lawmakers have long looked down on the partisan battles their national counterparts wage on Capitol Hill, saying we here in the Granite State are not like them. But how partisan are we? Now a new analysis examines the data. It tracks legislative votes in both the state House and Senate over the past 20 years. And it finds our state house is more partisan than lawmakers might like to think, at certain points even more so than inside the Beltway. Today in The Exchange, measuring New Hampshire partisanship. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or call in 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website NH Political Capital. Dean, really nice to see you. Welcome.
Hi, Laura.
Also with us, Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count. And Anna's group recently produced the analysis I just mentioned on partisanship, looking back over 20 years. And Anna, really nice to see you. Thank you, too.
Good morning.
So, Anna, why measure partisanship? And by the way, how'd you measure it?
Sure. So partisanship has been a conversation in the United States and New Hampshire since literally the start of the Constitution. So George Washington's farewell address, he famously addressed parties and said that they were cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men who would be enabled to destroy democracy.
Wow, he didn't like them very much, did he?
Not at all. Not at all. And him and many of the other founding fathers had debate about this, and it's continued since then. And on both sides, about party loyalty being important, too. You know, Ronald Reagan had the so-called 11th commandment that was thou shalt not speak ill of any fellow Republican.
Right.
So my question was, you know, we talk about this at the national level. What about the state level? So the measure I looked at was party unity. This has been used by the Journal Congressional Quarterly back to the 1940s. And it looks at all of the votes that were taken. And it says, what votes was there a majority of Democrats voting against a majority of Republicans? So it's looking at how often were those a clear line in the sand where it was one party versus another.
So looking at those times when the line in the sand, so to speak, was very firmly drawn and very few members of either party were towing across that line.
Exactly.
Why did you think this was important to do, Anna, at this moment in time?
I think that the conversation right now about partisanship is particularly heated. We hear it all the time from lawmakers. You know, Governor Sununu most recently in his budget address was kind of spanking Democrats, you know, but calling for bipartisanship. And then the Democrats said that wasn't bipartisan at all. That was a very partisan speech. And of course, at the national level, we hear conversations about partisanship, hyperpartisanship all the time. And so we have this narrative in New Hampshire that we're different. The parties don't have as much influence. And we wanted to see, okay, if you look at this party unity measure, which is just one measure of partisanship, what does that look like?
Sure. And as you said, Congressional Quarterly uses this measure going back many, many decades. So that's the measure we'll use today. And Dean, mm-hmm. Anna's right. The conversation is so much these days about partisanship and a lot of Americans sort of wagging their heads sadly and saying this partisanship thing is bad. How do you think most people view the notion of partisanship, Dean?
You're correct. Most people bemoan partisanship. They bemoan the polarization in our politics, but especially when it's on the other side. So there is a little bit of choosing one side or the other for sure. You know, voters tend to be, in general, less polarized than legislatures. You know, we talk about the American electorate. There's a debate about whether it's slightly right of center or maybe slightly left of center. And you typically see the legislatures being further out on the two ideological polls, more polarized. And there are a number of reasons reasons for that. Legislators are more likely to be political activists. They're more likely to be plugged into national local party networks, which pulls them a little further to the left or right. Some states, the issue is partisan gerrymandering, which we now know is inching towards a test in the federal courts. So there are a variety of reasons. But it is always the case that we think of voters as being kind of in the middle, watching this tennis match between liberals and conservatives, or progressives now, if you prefer, rather than talking about liberals. And so certainly there are some differences, and I think people dislike it, but it's also increasingly the way that we kind of view politics.
So voters say they dislike it. They want bipartisanship. We certainly hear candidates talking about, you know, I'm going to work with the other side. Yeah. On the other hand, voters say they want their party to stand for their principles. So it kind of seems to me, Dean, voters want it both ways.
Yeah, it's kind of like when you look at measures of approval of Congress. People give Congress very low marks, often in the teens or even single digits on occasion. But if you ask people whether they like their particular legislator, they say, yeah, I do like my member of Congress, or I do like my state legislator, and that bumps up the individual approval level. So yeah, there is this kind of trying to have it both ways and bemoaning. I hear people all the time just say, oh, the current environment is so partisan, it's so toxic, it's so polarized. But at the same time, they're typically very upset with the other side of the ideological spectrum and kind of pointing fingers. So we are trying to have it both ways.
Well, and Anna's research uses, again, that measure from Congressional Quarterly going back decades, party unity.
Sure.
So that's another way to look at it, that the parties are sticking together, and that means partisanship.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and there are ways of thinking about politics that focus more on what in political science we call a responsible party model, in which you elect a particular slate of legislators and a governor or a president, if you're talking about the national level, and that party enacts their agenda as a sort of a mandate. And then at the next election, you decide whether or not you like the outcome. And so the idea there is the party is responsible. It's a responsible party model. And so that's kind of a way things could work theoretically, and people like that idea. But as we know in practice, particularly as we lose kind of the center of the ideological spectrum in legislative bodies, you're more likely to end up with two parties in the legislature that are highly polarized, and that the result of that is typically gridlock, because there's nobody in the center anymore to cut deals with.
I definitely want to hear from listeners this hour on this topic. Some of the questions that I'm wondering about and that I'd like to hear from you about is your own observations concerning partisanship in our state legislature. What ups and downs in partisanship have you seen at the State House? Do you think partisanship is necessarily bad? When might partisanship be a positive trend? Again, let's hear from you. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. And Anna, one more question before we get into the details of what you found. And it's really interesting to see the ups and downs of partisanship. There's some surprises in this research.
Yeah.
But one more question, Anna. From that citizen's perspective, you know, your organization's name is Citizens Count.
Yes.
So from that citizen's perspective, how does partisanship affect the things citizens they care about? Laws, budgets, and other policies?
Sure. So I think sometimes when you have party unity is really high, so you have it's a really a Democrats versus Republicans situation. Sometimes things that there was consensus or even the public is really behind will be turned into partisan issues, and it becomes much harder to pass. So, for example, family and medical leave insurance. If we went back a year, there was broad bipartisan support for the plan on Republicans and Democratic side in the legislature. It passed. And then as soon as Governor Sununu said the word income tax, it became this very polarized situation. And let's be fair. There are a lot of complexities to the different plans that have been put forward, and there are pros and cons. But there was general support among the public for this concept of a statewide family medical leave insurance available to most people somehow. And we seem to have consensus moving that last year, but this year it's totally fallen apart. And at this point, I think it's hard to see where Democrats and Republicans can find common ground on this.
And just to jump in, it's fallen apart in a very specific way that tracks with your research, and that's over economic ideology.
Right.
It's this issue of how you pay for it. Is it an income tax? You know, as soon as Republicans started referring to the withholding as an income tax, the well was really poisoned in terms of that ever getting out. I mean, that really kind of blew the whole thing up. And so now the debate around family medical leave is no longer about whether or not families need this. It's about whether or not this is an income tax. So we've fallen back on this kind of clear ideological divide between the parties.
Right. So that's an example where partisanship has eroded support for an idea that most voters say they care about. Are there instances, Dean, where partisanship has been good in terms of this, you know, citizens agenda, laws, policies, budgets that people want passed?
Well, I mean, it's really a function of it all comes down in the end to the partisan balance in the legislature and whether or not you have a governor who's willing to sign it. So you can have a clear party agreement, the kind of responsible party model I was just talking about, where a party in a legislature drives a piece of legislation through. But then if you have a governor, as we're seeing in this circumstance, Governor Sununu has already talked about vetoing a number of bills coming out of the legislature. And it's funny, and I watch the state legislature, you know, you get the press releases that say the House and the Senate have passed, you know, legislation A or legislation B, and it's right out of the sort of the Democratic agenda. And as soon as I see it, I say, there's no way Governor Sununu is going to sign that. So there's an example of where a party is driving an agenda, and what they will say is, we're doing what you want, but we can't get it through this governor. Give us a Democratic governor. And you could make the same argument for Republicans back when you had Democratic governors.
Well, and as research shows, too, a lot of things happen between the House and the Senate, and the House usually has this more partisan-driven agenda, depending on who is controlling it, and then things tend to cool down a little bit in the Senate. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. But I want to remind our listeners, too, the number for you to join us on this question of partisanship here in the Granite State, based on a new study done by Citizens Count, looking at votes over the past 20 years, is 1-800-892-6477. Join us, 1-800-892-6477, with your own observations and questions. You can email us as well. It's exchange@nhpr.org. And both of you, Lorraine is calling in from Nashua. Hi, Lorraine. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you, Laura. I have a comment and a question. Years ago, there used to be a civilized debate about an issue. Democrats and Republicans go back and forth on it. You know, they tell us the finer points, and then they vote. And now it seems to have deteriorated to a mudslinging. You know, if you don't like my way, then it's the highway. What happened? What caused that? And why aren't we debating these issues, getting everything out into the open and saying, okay, this is the best solution for the people of New Hampshire? I mean, it seems to me that there's a lot of this mudslinging and name-calling and nothing gets done. You know, hasn't been any significant changes to any transportation problems or economic problems, or, you know, there aren't any solutions out there. And once a solution happens, somebody attacks it.
Well, Lorraine, thank you.
Why aren't we civilized debate?
Thank you very much for the call. And I'll let you know, Lorraine, that Christopher in Manchester also sent us a note. He says, it seems ironic that there are fewer and fewer moderate Democrats and Republicans these days elected to office in New Hampshire, while the majority of voters now register as undeclared or independent. Doesn't that indicate voters prefer less extremist views? So, Dean, there's Christopher and Lorraine saying, why can't we meet in the middle?
Yeah, those are great comments. And it is the case that the ideological center, just as it is true for Congress, is also true for state legislatures. The ideological center has been hollowed out. So there really is no one in the middle or few people in the middle to cut the kinds of bipartisan deals that legislatures regularly cut in the past. And the other issue, getting to the callers, to Lorraine's comment about the tenor of the debate. We haven't talked yet about the impact of social media. I would also throw in the impact of changes in campaign finance or loosening of campaign finance regulations and the increasing involvement of outside groups as a result. I mean, I remember back doing this in the 1990s, and you did not have the level of outside involvement of national groups. And so local legislators through social media and technology are now plugged into national networks that are much more partisan. They're more ideologically focused. It's fascinating to me, if you go back to the founding and the Federalist Papers, the Defense of the Constitution, James Madison in Federalist 10 was very concerned about faction and tyranny. And his great argument was that the larger the country, the better we're off, because like-minded individuals won't be able to find each other to execute their plans of oppression. social media and the internet has completely undercut the idea that like-minded individuals can no longer find each other, right? They can find each other all over the world. And so that has fundamentally changed what was a fairly kind of, you know, insulated or somewhat protected legislative ecosystem into this much larger, more partisan, ideologically focused national party networks.
I want to play a clip from former New Hampshire Governor John Lynch, because he reflected on this trend that you mentioned, Lorraine. This is from a farewell interview that we did with Governor Lynch on The Exchange back in 2013. As you both know, Governor Lynch served 4 terms, so 8 years. A lot of changes over that time. Lynch told me that over his 8 years, he tried to be bipartisan, but he did say the party so-called lines in the sand were drawn more sharply in his later years in office. Let's hear.
Well, it was that way the last couple of years. I hadn't experienced that in the previous 6 years. And I suspect and expect that the legislature will return to more normalcy, the way it's traditional in New Hampshire, where there's a greater degree of civility than what we saw the last couple of years.
Why do you suppose that's going to happen? What's the cause
for optimism? I think there's more of a balance now. I think the people of New Hampshire want us to work together. They expect us to be more centrist in the way we manage problems. They expect us to be pragmatic. And so I believe that the governor-elect, as well as this legislature, will be more in that tone, the way the people of New Hampshire really want us to be.
And when he said governor-elect, he meant Governor Hassan, the way the people of New Hampshire expect us to be. Anna, let's talk about the way that the legislature has acted over the years. It was really interesting to hear that clip from Governor Lynch. So you looked over 20 years, Anna, and let's start with the House, because as we said earlier, that's the body that tends to reflect more sharply the partisan ups and downs here in the state. In general, your study finds that the House is the more partisan body. A lot of listeners will say, yeah, I don't find that surprising. What did you pick up on from looking at those House votes over the past 20 years, Anna? What's the big takeaway?
Yes. Well, the big trend is that it is increasing. So once again, this party unity measure, it's looking how often is it majority Democrats versus majority Republicans. And it's happening more and more. There have been ups and downs that we can see, but in particular, 2019 so far is the highest level yet.
Really?
88 as of April.
Over 20 years.
Over 20 years. And so we're at 88% right now in the House. That means 88% of votes, it was the majority of one party versus the majority of other, and only 12% of votes where you had people on both sides generally agreeing that something was a good idea or a bad idea. So that's pretty remarkable. And I also think it's pretty remarkable that it is that upward trend, even with the ups and downs, because we like to think that we're sort of isolated from this national bad trend of partisanship. And once again, as we discussed, is it bad? There are good and bad things about party unity, but we aren't escaping it here in New Hampshire.
It's interesting, too. 2019, you said, is the, I don't want to say worst for partisanship, but
sure.
Strongest for partisanship so far in the New Hampshire House. Even beating out 2010, 2011, Anna, which was also a very partisan time in New Hampshire, according to your charts.
Yeah. So if you're looking, there's sort of, you know, peaks and troughs. And the last time it was in the, you know, 80% range like this, it was 2009, 2010, and 2011. So there were a couple things going on then, most notably the Tea Party wave. So in that election of 2010, at the state and national level, we had a lot of very conservative Republicans coming in, fiscal conservatives in particular. And after that, though, right after 2010, it did go down, because I think in New Hampshire, or I should say after 2011, it did go down, because I think that there was a little bit of a reaction in New Hampshire saying, oh, wow, okay, this is really inflamed now. And it backed off a little bit.
Well, those graphs were really interesting. We're going to talk about them more after a break. And Dean, I'll get your reflections as well. We will look at that other very partisan time that you mentioned, Anna, 2010, 2011, Speaker O'Brien, and then sort of how the Republican Party reacted to that. I'm also going to ask both of you, which party tends to be more partisan? And the answer is surprising. I'm not going to give it away now. But we will talk about that after a short break. And we'll keep taking your calls. So, Lorraine, thank you for that one. Thank you for the emails. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number, 1-800-892-6477. We're gauging partisanship at the New Hampshire State House this hour in the Exchange. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back.
NHPR's Leadership Circle is a community of listeners who place a high value on thorough and thoughtful journalism. I'm Sarah Alger, Director of Major Giving. As a member of the Leadership Circle, your monthly investment of $100 or a single gift of $1,200 helps us create and deliver the news you trust and the programs you love. Take a moment to think about the essential role NHPR plays in your life and consider deepening your commitment to the station. Give online at nhpr.org/leaders.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, a history of partisanship in the Granite State. A new analysis by Citizens Count of House and Senate voting records gauges how partisan our state has become, at least in the terms of our legislature. We're looking at the data. We're hearing some of the stories behind partisanship at the State House. And we'd love to hear from you. What ups and downs in partisanship have you seen? When might partisanship be helpful? When is it harmful? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Anna Brown is here, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count. Also, Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And Dean, just before the break, we were talking about Anna's data, looking at the past 20 years, again, of party unity or partisanship, whatever you want to call it, at the New Hampshire House, first of all. And she said her data shows 2019 is the most partisan ever at the House. And I wonder what you think.
Yeah, no, it doesn't surprise me. I think a couple things are going on. I think part of it is that it's a reflection of what's going on at the national level, the real polarized debate over President Trump's administration and congressional reaction to it among Democrats. And so I think that as I mentioned earlier, my comments about social media and the way technology has changed influences that come into New Hampshire, I think that it really is in part a reflection of that larger debate that the country is having right now about the direction. I just listening to the kind of the rhetoric of key politicians in the state, it sounds a lot more like the national level than it used to. And then I think part of that is a function of technology. And when I first started to hear the national kind of political elite debate seeping into state legislative rhetoric was Bill O'Brien with the voter ID, which was a big thing with Republicans around the country, even though it was not so much an issue here. And I recall hearing O'Brien speak as speaker and catching phrases and agenda items that you really were only hearing about nationally, not so much locally. And he was kind of bringing that in. And that really was the beginning. You remember, the iPhone really didn't come out until 2007. So social media was just starting to gain steam then. Now it's, you know, full tilt, Twitter, Instagram, et cetera.
So speaking of that time, I'm glad you mentioned it, Dean, because in 2012, House Speaker Bill O'Brien, as you said, was overseeing a debate about requiring photo IDs for voting. And there was some dissent, not just among Democrats, but among Republicans about this. This shows some of the fissures in the Republican Party.
Also on the gun debate, too. I started hearing stuff that I was hearing elsewhere in the country.
Right to work. That's another one.
Wisconsin.
So I want to play this clip. And then, Anne, I want to ask you about why your research found that Democrats are actually the more partisan or party unified. But let's hear a little bit from Bill O'Brien. This is a debate on those photo IDs for voting. We're going to hear Republican Representative Steve Valancourt from Manchester. He's upset here that he and others weren't given a chance to weigh in on the bill. This clip begins with Speaker O'Brien.
You continue to allude to it in your debates. We'll allow
Mr. Speaker, point of order. You just ruled
you just
that you can only
the chair,
speak if it's in the committee report.
You will bring
There's nothing in the committee
the
report.
Sergeant at Arms will bring Representative Valancourt to order.
Are you going to treat everybody fairly or not?
Representative Valancourt. Another outburst like that, you'll be removed from the hall.
Zeke Heil.
Representative, the Sergeant at Arms will remove Representative Valancourt from the hall.
Okay, so a heated moment. And Anna, it's among Republicans. And your research shows that actually party unity or partisanship is stronger among Democrats.
Yes. And so this is interesting, too, because as I said, It was extreme. Party unity overall in the House was extremely high in 2009, 2010, and 2011. And it dropped down in 2012. That clip we just heard was from 2012. And this is when I think you started to see a bit of a fissure in the Republican Party in terms of fiscal conservatives, libertarians, social conservatives. And ultimately in New Hampshire, if you go a few years later down the road, we have, you know, Bill O'Brien losing the speakership after a surprise speaker coming in, which we can talk a little bit about in the Sean Jasper in 2015. So there was that fissure in the Republican Party that started right around Valancourt's Sieg Heil comment. Very controversial. He was a Republican. And so, yeah, Democrats in New Hampshire do tend to have the higher party unity, especially when they're in power in the House, which to me, it's not necessarily that they're more partisan in a bad way, but they aren't seeing those same fissures that we've seen in the Republican Party of late.
Or maybe they stuff them down because
they might have better party discipline.
They have been in the minority for a while in the state house, and now they're in the majority. So I wonder if we're going to start seeing some of that party disunity that we have seen among Republicans that we just heard.
Well, and Anna, you just used the phrase where I was going to head, which is party discipline. The Democratic Party in New Hampshire, by all measures, is more professionalized as a party. It's more organized. It has more money. And I think that makes it a little bit easier to enforce party discipline as a kind of a structural matter. We're also coming out of a period in which the Republican Party, certainly in 2015, we talk about Sean Jasper. At that time, this pre-President Trump, the party was really riven with these fissures over Trump, never Trump. Now that's all kind of shaken out. We've seen the Republican Party actually be criticized for being overly supportive of President Trump and discourage a primary challenge to President Trump. So that's kind of played out now, and you see greater unity and support for President Trump in the Republican Party. But as a structural matter, for years the Democratic Party has kind of been more organized and well funded and disciplined, separate from ideology. And you know, the Democrats may now face a similar issue in 2020. We just saw President Obama was over, I think, in Germany, in Berlin, giving a talk, and he warned Democrats about purity tests in the Democratic primary for president, that the party was getting a little bit too focused on ideological purity, and that could hurt the party in the long term. So some of the things I think that affected the Republicans with their big presidential primary field and the controversy over President Trump, we may see some of that now going forward in the Democratic field, and that will, of course, because of social media and technology, trickle down to state level.
Yeah, I definitely am wondering to myself, so party unity in New Hampshire right now, particularly among Democrats, very, very high. But if we're looking at the Democratic presidential primary, talk about a lack of a clear party unity there. There's a huge swath of candidates who range from incredibly socially liberal, I mean, arguably socialist. I mean, Bernie Sanders, I think, would not have a problem being called a socialist, versus much more moderate, such as John Delaney, who votes with Republicans a lot of times. So will that end up trickling down to Democrats in New Hampshire as well, or are they going to stay more unified?
So that party unity that we're seeing among Democrats is why your numbers show, Anna, in the House anyway. We'll talk about the Senate in a few minutes.
Yes.
In the House, anyway, party unity is very strong. Partisanship is very strong.
Yes.
Democrats are voting one way in the House. Republicans are voting another way in the House.
Yes.
It's also the case that just as a structural and institutional matter, a large legislative body like the House of Representatives is more hierarchical. There's more an emphasis on leadership. You know, you look at the U.S. Congress, a lot of members of the House of the majority party typically vote 93, 94, 95% of the time with their party leadership. So I think there's just, as a structural matter, of getting a 400-person body to function, you're going to have more hierarchy and enforced party discipline and unity.
Here's an email that came in from Michael that I'd like to share. He says, I've been a registered Democrat and an independent. I struggle to find common values with today's Democratic Party, and more importantly, the direction it seems to be heading, at least at the national level. The problem, Michael says, is that adopting national problems and the partisan positions associated with them and then conflating them to the state level problems is a political winner. Michael, thank you so much for that. Two questions. Dean, you first.
Sure.
You mentioned this earlier, that about what, Dean, 10, 15 years ago, you did start to notice this national influence on
yeah.
the way we talk about state issues here.
Yeah. 2009, 2010, certainly with the Tea Party rebellion and then shortly after that, yeah.
And Anna, what did your research find about the influence of national partisanship on state legislative partisanship?
Well, this is an interesting little segue here because what I actually found is that over on average over the past 20 years, looking at party unity, New Hampshire House has higher party unity than the U.S. House of Representatives, which personally going into it, not what I expected
that was a surprise
to see
for
at
me
all.
Too.
But I was thinking more about it, and I think there are a couple things going on here. In New Hampshire, every single bill gets a vote. And I think in the U.S. House of Representatives, some of the bills don't even come to the floor because the leadership is essentially censoring them. So I think...
Yeah, most don't. Most don't.
Yeah, yeah.
So they get killed in committee.
Exactly. Yep. Yep. So I think that's a factor. But otherwise, even whether or not it's trickling down, it doesn't track a lot. You know, if you look at the chart, U.S. House party unity, New Hampshire House party unity, up until 2007, there was sort of a similar pattern, and then it's just kind of all over the place, and it doesn't track a lot. So I almost wonder if it's, you know, the party unity measure isn't what's going to mirror, but maybe it's that rhetoric. You know, the rhetoric is leaking down, but is that necessarily reflected in voting behavior in New Hampshire?
And that's also the case that the U.S. Congress represents a much broader geographical and economic and sectional set of interests than New Hampshire does. So within New Hampshire, just by definition of it being a small rural state, 95% white, et cetera, you're going to see a lot more homogeneity in what the two parties support.
Here's something else from the research that jumped out at me, Anna, and I thought, okay, that's interesting. I didn't realize that. The balance of power and how close the margins are. For example, Anna, if in the New Hampshire House, the parties are almost equal in terms of the numbers of lawmakers, do we see more partisanship or less? You would think if you had, almost 200 to 200 in the New Hampshire House, that there would be more bipartisanship. But what did you find?
Right. So I actually found that the closer the number of Democrats and Republicans, the higher that level of party unity. And so,
which is really interesting.
Yeah. So it's as you might think that, and most of the time in New Hampshire, when there's been a big majority, it's been Republican. And you would think that Democrats would really rally and they'd try to keep it tight and there would be more of those conflicts. But no, it was when the Democrats and Republicans were neck and neck. And reflecting on that, I think it's partly because Democrats and Republicans in that situation know they have to have that party discipline and muster all of the votes to get anything through. Because particularly if we're looking at average attendance around, 4 out of 5 representatives on a given vote day, are you going to have enough of your party to get it through? You better hope every single one of them has their butts in their seats to vote.
That's interesting. Instead of the idea, Dean, of, the margins are really close for us. We had best work with a couple members on the other side to try to get them to join us.
Yeah, well, I think when a legislature is closely split like that, it's a kind of a real reflection of a split in the electorate and the battle lines being drawn, et cetera, and kind of the mentality, I think, is similar to what Anna described. The interesting thing is if you look at, take the last 60 or 70 years and you look at the U.S. Congress, you find that under conditions of unified government, when you have a president and partisan majorities of one party, it actually becomes more difficult to get things done. What you find is when a party has large majorities in a state or national legislature, fissures within the party start to develop where things that maybe were not possible legislatively under closely divided government, people start to say, well, if we can do X, maybe we could do Y. And you start to see these incredible internal debates within the party when you would think, in theory, because they have a president or a governor and a legislature of the same party, stuff should move forward more quickly, and you have this responsible party effect, you don't. You get all these internal battles over, now's our opportunity, let's see what we can do, and they can't agree on anything.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at 2017 in New Hampshire, all right, Republican House, Republican Senate, Republican governor, the House could not pass a budget. They could not agree. They could not get a simple majority to pass a budget, which is the most basic thing you have to get through. So as Dean says, if you don't have that really close competition, it can just lead to, people sort of not being able to agree. All right, we have all this power. What do we do with it?
Yeah. And sometimes, as you said, they go overboard. They say, let's do everything. And then that's overreach.
There's too much disagreement.
Yeah. All right, let's take another call. And Wallace is joining us from Sandwich. Hi, Wallace. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. Great program. First of all, I wanted to say that thank you to Professor Spiliotis for bringing up social media, which I think is a huge part of the partisan divide in this country. I do think also that national politics have leached down into small communities in New Hampshire like Sandwich, and I wanted to add a personal touch, a sad personal touch, by simply offering that I have lost three very, very close friends, one immediately after the 2016 election, another because he wouldn't take off his Hillary for prison button, and a third because of what happened in Charlottesville, where I simply tried to talk about how I was feeling about that horrible, horrible thing. And the last thing I will say is that politics used to be relational, community-based, extremely personal, and now everything is so atomized. Witness the number of Democrats, for instance, running on different issues, and I am a very left-leaning liberal Democrat, I will say, but it has come to the point now where, in part because of social media, our communities have basically imploded, and the personal, what used to be the productive personal, I would call it, has become almost absurdly impersonal, to the point where we literally have to decide, you know, I can't be friends with you, and I'll take your comments. Thank you very much for getting me on.
Wallace, it's so nice to hear from you. And old timers used to tell me in the state legislature, and this is going way back, that before I-93 became efficient, fast, lawmakers had to spend the night in Concord when they were having a busy session. They would all stay at the old Highway Hotel.
Same in Washington.
They would, exactly, before jet air travel became fast and efficient. They would all stay at the old Highway Hotel, and there are stories of them going down to the bar, having a couple drinks, sitting around the piano, singing songs, and figuring stuff out. And certainly that is not what we're seeing today. Go ahead, Anna.
Well, I just wanted to talk a little bit more about social media because, as the caller brought up, as Dean originally brought up, it is a huge factor. And there are some really interesting studies coming out about how Democrats and Republicans are interacting or not interacting on social media. And one of them in particular that I thought was interesting showed that if you see posts from someone of the opposite side, you're actually more likely to get more inflamed. Mm-hmm. It's rather, there's something different about social media. If you have two people that are sitting across a table and they're talking to each other, and one's a Democrat and one's a Republican, it personalizes it, and it'll usually lead to more civility in the conversation. Whereas online, the opposite seems to happen. Whereas it's the post, it's anonymized, and it ends up to lead to more negative feelings. This was one of the reasons why Facebook engineers came out and said, well, we think it's okay that we sort of have created these echo chambers where you only see things that you like, because look at this study. If we show people things from the other side, it might actually make things more polarized, which I think it's an important debate to have. Are we going to isolate ourselves to only seeing things that we like, that we agree with, or are we going to try to engage online where, yeah, it's ugly? How can we fight that?
Yeah, it's the whole issue that I mentioned earlier with, you know, James Madison writing in Federalist 10 about like-minded individuals, the issue of whether or not they can find each other and cause problems. You know, we now have this ability to find people who share our views anywhere in the world, and it's human nature to kind of want to be part of those communities. And it's ironic to me that, you know, here's this medium, these platforms that are very intimate, they're very personal. You can talk directly with people all around the world. Yet it's almost, the discussion is almost less nuanced rather than more nuanced. And I think it is the loss of those personal relationships that you mentioned, Laurie. I hear congressmen and women complain about that all the time, that, you know, in the old days in Washington, people stayed in the city more often. They would get drinks together. Now, you know, they're in 3 or 4 days a week and then they fly right back home.
Well, Anna, when was the time the House was the least partisan? We've talked a lot about when it was most partisan. When was it the least partisan?
So the lowest House unity happened in 2004. And if we're looking at that, well, the first thing, obviously, is the Patriots won the Super Bowl and the Red Sox won the World Series. So I guess everyone was in a good mood. But also we saw, you know, Governor John Lynch come into office. And that was, he was preceded by Craig Benson, who was very controversial. So I think that, you know, maybe that sort of triggered a reaction and people said, all right, let's calm down. Let's work together.
All right. Coming up, we will talk about the state Senate, its times of partisanship and bipartisanship. It's a lot different from the House. We'll tell you how in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Recently on The Exchange, we explored a particularly New Hampshire institution.
A town minus its general store has a huge hole in it, and people know that. Even if you don't stop at the general store, you want there to be one, because you know that that's like having the lights on. It's the pilot light of your town, and if it's out, you feel like there's something wrong.
The Exchange is your place for New Hampshire conversations. Every weekday at 9 a.m., only on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, sports betting may be coming to the Granite State. We'll find out more tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, a review of partisanship at the New Hampshire State House, how it has waxed and waned over the past 20 years, and some of the big differences between the New Hampshire House and the New Hampshire Senate. Let's get your thoughts in too. 1-800-892-6477. What ups and downs in partisanship at the State House have you seen? Is partisanship necessarily bad? When might partisanship be useful or positive? We'd love to hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Anna Brown is here, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, which just recently published two studies on partisanship in the legislature. Dean Spiliotis is also with us, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And Dean, just before the break, I was asking Anna, okay, we've been talking a lot about when has the New Hampshire House been at its most partisan. I also asked Anna, when has the New Hampshire House been at its least partisan? She mentioned 2004, Governor Lynch, a very bipartisan figure, kind of setting the tone. When else have you seen, again, looking at Anna's study, the New Hampshire House at its least partisan?
Yeah, this is an interesting period. If you look at roughly 1999, 2000, up to about 2004, there's a lot going on in this period. I mean, I'm speculating a little bit, but my guess is that by 2000, 2001, people are burned out after the Clinton impeachment, the Bush versus Gore in the Supreme Court, and everybody's just kind of taking a deep breath. And then that's immediately followed by 9/11, and you have a rally effect around the president, the entire country. Even in 2002, President Bush gained seats at the midterm, and the
which
only
is
other
unusual.
Yeah, and the only other time that happened in the 20th century, I believe, was 1998, which is Bill Clinton when he's right around impeachment. So I just think the country was having a moment where people were trying to catch their breath, and then dealing with 9/11, and then it's really not till 2005, 2006 when we're encountering difficulties in Iraq and Afghanistan. The economy is starting to slip, and then that sets up the preconditions for the Democratic tsunami in 2006.
Got an email here from Fred who says, I have witnessed committee work in which one after another person testified in favor of a bill, and the vote, often following a recess for party caucus, came party line against it. Fred says, another observation, one of my local legislators observed that being a legislator is a lot more fun when you're in the majority. Fred also asks, can you explain roll call vote versus division vote versus voice vote? And Fred, thank you so much. And Anna, go ahead.
Yes. So there are three different ways that they can record votes in the House. So we'll start with a voice vote. That's literally the speaker just asks people to say aye or nay, and the louder group gets it, whoever sounds like it has more. So that's really reserved for really uncontroversial things, because where it's going to be really clear who's in the majority and who's not. So voice vote, unfortunately, you don't know how everyone voted, and there can be a debate about that. Division vote is a recorded vote, so everyone has to cast an individual ballot, but it's not assigned by name. So once again, we can't tell where did it fall on party lines, who voted which way or another.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
So that might be, once again, it's not hugely controversial. Legislators aren't concerned about getting their opponents on the record, but they want to make sure they have an exact number. And so there's no guessing about the voice vote, who was more. Lastly, there's the roll call vote, and this is the one that I was examining. So a roll call vote means every vote is recorded by name, so you know how it breaks down on party, geographic area, however you want to look at it. And if you look over the past 20 years, I will say that if you're just looking at roll call votes as a percentage of all bills, it's actually only about a third. So there are a lot of votes in New Hampshire that happen that are not recorded, and they can be voice votes, very uncontroversial, maybe procedural. But that's just something to keep in mind, is that when you're looking at roll calls already it's going to be probably a more controversial bill.
Well, that's interesting. And we just received an email from Representative Susan Almy. She's a Democrat representing Grafton. She says, you are looking at the most extreme measures of party separation when you only look at the votes that get a roll call on the floor of the House. So that's what you were just saying, Anna. First, Representative Almy says the huge majority of issues are decided without a roll call. You are looking at how that percentage changes over time. She says, we spend most of our time in committees working out the best solutions among individuals, much less often parties. The one or two really bad terms of my 12 have been when the party leadership tried to force committee leaders to toe the ideological line. Mm. Representative Almy also writes, the floor action has changed because roll calls have become a tool of small groups of activists trying to get everybody on record so they can try and convince voters to remove individual reps in their own party or region they disagree with. And Representative Almy says, because the most recent Republican leaders since the Tea Party years entered the legislature have insisted on unity on those votes, and individually Democrats have reacted to that by circling the wagons. Really interesting, Representative Almy. Thank you for writing in. Dean, what do you think?
Yeah, that's great. Great feedback and great insight into how things are playing out on the ground in the state legislature. Certainly the case, the roll call votes tend to be highest profile. I think to some extent the strategy described there about trying to get people on the record to use it for electoral purposes, I mean, that's always kind of been out there. And, you know, in some sense, it's probably fair to say that the issues that go to roll calls are the ones that probably are most salient for people, that are kind of the ones that everybody's talking about on social media, kind of the big ticket items of any political agenda. And most people don't pay a lot of attention to the stuff that just kind of goes through because it's not something on which there's a clear ideological divide.
Sure. You were working with what you had, though, Anna. You
exactly.
can't sit in on every single committee and see how things get hashed
out. And so that's worth noting. There are many ways to measure partisanship. OK, so there's something called the approval gap, which is you look at the difference between approval of Republicans and Democrats based on the party of the people in the poll. Polling. There's something called a DW nominate model, which maps legislators spatially based on how their votes cluster. So you can look at all different sorts of similarities between them, regional, what industry they're in. You can survey legislators. You can do linguistic analysis of rhetoric. This is just one measure. And I think, as Susan Almy noted, Rep. Almy noted, absolutely, this is looking at the most controversial votes. But since it's consistent over time, we can see those trends. So I wouldn't say right now that it's 88% partisan. No, because there's other things happening, other votes that we aren't recording. But I can say conclusively, well, this is way higher than it was any other time in the past 2 decades, because this is a consistent measure.
Well, and you work with the data that you have. As you said, you don't have some of those other votes. But
yes.
I really appreciate the point, Representative Almy. And Brian also wrote us. He says, good topic, but it's important to remember where the data comes from. Roll call votes are not a random sampling, but only happens at the request of members. In recent years, the HRA, I'm assuming that's the House Republican Alliance, which is a conservative group of lawmakers, often requests them to show differences among the Republican members, trying to catch them doing something wrong in order to use that data during a primary. This has the effect of making the Democrats appear more partisan. Interesting, Brian. He says there are also more roll call votes in recent years. He says another measure would be to look at the number of bills that pass on the consent calendar. These are issues that are agreed to by all members and all parties. Tracking this number might be a better model to seeing how many issues all parties agree on. I'm wondering what's on that consent calendar, though. Is it about healthcare and taxes, controversial stuff, or is it about renaming a post office?
Yeah, I mean, if it's on the consent calendar, that means that there's not expected to be a lot of debate and controversy over the bill. So it can be housekeeping bills. You know, we need to make this administrative change or just things that there's going to be broad consensus on. So that's an interesting question. I out of curiosity now, I'm going to go back and look. That'd be easy enough to see how many are appearing on consent calendars every year and take a look.
Yeah, and what the topics are.
Yeah, this issue of how to operationalize your research is something political scientists always deal with. You spend a lot of time learning about it in graduate school. You know, maybe there's an enterprising grad student at UNH who's listening to this who wants to create some of these measures. You know, roll call votes are widely used at the congressional level. Sometimes you have the Congressional Quarterly calculates these batting scores, almost like a baseball batting score of how frequently a member of Congress agrees with his or her president. So it's not that unusual, but it is interesting to hear how the kind of quirks of the New Hampshire state legislature might shape what rises to the level of a roll call.
Well, I love that our listeners are putting on their political science caps and joining us with this analysis. And to this issue of the roll call votes, and as Brian says, being used more and more, I want to play a little clip from 2014. This is then Representative Sean Jasper, Republican, speaking before the House. He was challenging the current Speaker of the House, Bill O'Brien, in an election. O'Brien's allies moved for a roll call vote rather than a secret ballot, that's what we're talking about, angering many Republicans and Democrats because it would allow, again, for these voting records to be made public. Opponents said it wasn't fair to change the rules without a discussion or providing warning. And we want to thank our colleague Josh Rogers for this clip that we're about to hear. This is from 2014.
I just came out of a caucus where I was essentially yelled at for 15 minutes without the opportunity to respond.
The House will be in order. The member is allowed to speak.
And this is my concern. This is why I am standing here. The House deserves better. We deserve to respect each other. I am a Republican, and I know many will say I'm not. I have been a Republican since before I was registered to vote.
Again, that's Sean Jasper, who then became Speaker of the House with Democratic support. That voice you heard, by the way, Karen Wadsworth, former clerk, kind of calling people to order and getting them to fall in line. What did you make of that, Dean?
Yeah, it speaks to the issue of kind of civility and the heated nature of partisan rhetoric. It also speaks to that, as I mentioned earlier, that period of time where the Republican Party was really trying to figure out what its identity was going to be going into the 2016 election, and Democrats saw an opportunity to get Jasper into the speakership. And so it's the kind of politics that really fits in with the kind of broader partisan nature of the legislature.
All right. We spent a lot of time on the House, which makes sense because it is the more partisan body in our state
more
House.
Of them, there's 400.
But let's talk about the state Senate, Anna. And how is the state Senate different than the House when it comes to partisanship?
Sure. Well, there are two things that I would note right off the bat. So once again, just looking at roll call votes in the Senate, because they have a similar thing where, you know, they aren't going to always record everyone's vote individually, much lower party unity than in the House. So if we're talking about
much more bipartisanship, to put it another way,
potentially, yeah, much more agreement on either for a bill or against a bill. And also not increasing over the past 20 years.
That's interesting.
Yes. So there have been peaks, there have been troughs, but roughly steady, and really not a huge uptick in 2019 at all in the Senate.
How much is that baked into the cake already, Dean, of the state Senate?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting. There's a famous saying about the U.S. Senate that the Senate is the cooling saucer of democracy, that the Senate is designed. Some people would say that's not so much the case anymore, but historically the Senate had kind of been where you sort of step back, take a breather, and cool things down a bit. You know, I think it's a function of, you know, it's certainly larger senatorial districts, so you have a little bit more of a diverse constituency to represent. But it's also the case, I think, simply that the smaller size allows for more interpersonal relationships and collegiality. Senators in general tend to view themselves more as independent actors or free agents, even if they're part of the party. And you know, there's research out there showing that when you have a greater interpersonal give and take, it humanizes the individuals, and so your relationship becomes kind of more nuanced, more collegial. So it's just a fundamentally different, structurally speaking, a different dynamic.
In over the 20-year span that you looked at, when did you find partisanship at its highest in the state Senate, recognizing again that it's not as partisan a body as the House?
Sure. So party unity was very high in 2001, and it was also very high in 2003 and 2011. So if we start at 2001, that's when Jean Shaheen came in with her sales tax proposal to fund school funding. And so I think that, you know, the year prior to that, it was actually pretty low party unity. And there was in 2000, there was actually an equal number of Democrats and Republicans in the Senate, 12 and 12.
Right. So, I remember that.
Yeah. So 2001, things shifted. It got more partisan that year for sure. 2003, that was under Governor Craig Benson. There was a lot of controversy. There was a couple different squabbles between Democrats and Republicans about rules in the Senate. For example, should party caucuses be subject to the right to know laws? And then the other time that I would note is 2011 was the highest point for the House. And there was a huge...
You mean the Senate?
I'm sorry. Yes. 2011 was the highest point for the Senate. Sorry, we were talking about the House right. all morning. And I think that once again, we're talking about that. That was, there was the big Tea Party wave. There was a lot of more partisan talk at both the national and state level. And so I saw that kind of leaking into the Senate.
Well, again, there was that very austere budget in 2011. The recession had really whacked state revenues. And then you had Bill O'Brien, you know, creating a pretty partisan atmosphere in the House, and some of that bleeded over to the Senate.
Absolutely.
So, go
also
ahead,
worth noting in the Senate, so those high periods I'm talking about, 2003, 2011, Republican majorities in the Senate. And so this is the opposite of what I observed in the state House, where when you got that little, and it was, there were never huge Democrat majorities in the New Hampshire House, but when you got that little majority, on average, party unity ticked up a little bit. The opposite was true in the Senate. When we had big Republican majorities in the Senate, which have happened, like I said, 2003, 2011, there was a jump in party unity. So there's a different party dynamic in the Senate for sure.
I found that surprising, too, Anna.
Yeah.
Dean, I have to ask you about that. It's sure. so interesting. So just to make sure I've got it right, when Democrats have the majority in the House, they behave in a more unified or partisan way. When Democrats have the majority in the Senate, they behave in a more bipartisan or ununified way, Anna? Do I have that right?
Well, yeah. Or you, I mean, yeah, it's a little bit how you talk about it, right? Because it's party unity. It's how much the parties are voting together. Is that the same as partisanship? Is partisanship more about rhetoric and acrimony? You know, it's a very loaded term, but certainly, yes, your general statement of how you're putting it would be correct.
Dean?
Yeah, hard to know. I mean, you could speculate, but I again come back to there are a few state legislatures in the country where you have this kind of really starkly different institutional design, you know, 24 individuals versus 400.
Yeah.
Completely different dynamics.
Gap.
So it's not surprising to me that you would find you know, differing outcomes in terms of the level of partisanship. Certainly the Senate here is a very different body than what you see with the 400 in the House.
What about the governor, Dean? Anna's research yeah. covered votes in the House, votes in the Senate. But going through the research and going through some of the history in preparation for the show, it does seem a governor sets the tone.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because, you know, typically if you were to ask me how you get elected governor in New Hampshire, it's to run as kind of a fairly centrist politician, you know, bring in the independents and the folks from your own party, try to distance yourself from the polarization at the national level. But inevitably, once you get into office, you start to see these oppositions. And as we just saw, Governor Sununu talking about how he's likely to do a lot of vetoing.
All right. Both of you. We could have talked a lot longer. Thank you so much for being here, Dean. It was great to see you.
Yes, thanks, Laura.
Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of NH Political Capital. Anna Brown, thank you for your time. Really appreciate
it. Pleasure.
Anna Brown is Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, which produced the studies that we talked about today on partisanship in the New Hampshire House and the New Hampshire Senate. You can find links to those studies on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And you're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.